Sure. Looking through horn-rimmed glasses with what Grandma India called criminal eyes. Mr. Whalen sometimes greeted us cordially. There were even times when he inspired a nervous laugh from Mother and Daddy with his placating chatter. His store was one of my favorite places because going there was sometimes like going to a neighborhood party. Mostly our people shopped there, although a few whites from a nearby neighborhood came there too. There was sawdust on the floor, and the air was filled with the aroma of spices, fruits, onions, nuts, and potatoes. Maybe it was the festive colors and sounds that reminded me of a party. Early one Friday evening, when the store was crowded, our entire family went in for a shopping spree. We had Mama's teaching check, Daddy's railroad check, and the money Grandma India had earned from her work as a maid. It was one of those times when we all felt joy and peace and lots of hope. I looked forward to the bill paying because the grocer sometimes rewarded Conrad and me with sugar daddy suckers after the grown-ups handed over the money. Grandma was the first to look over Mr. Whalen's bill. Her forehead wrinkled. She mumbled and handed it to Daddy. He looked it over and talked to her with his eyes. By the time Mother examined the bill, all their faces were grim. They quickly moved Conrad and me with them to a corner of the store. They were certain the bill overcharged them by $22. That was more than a day's pay, Daddy said. Still, they seemed frightened to speak up. After lots of whispered angry words, they decided to complain. Although Grandma approached the grocer in a calm, respectful way, he shouted back at her in an angry voice, loud enough for everyone within a block to hear. He said he gave us credit when we didn't have eating money, so he expected us to pay without complaining. Seeing Daddy's jaw tighten and his eyes narrow, Grandma touched his hand to stay him. There was an ominous silence in the store. Everybody was staring at us. Other people in the store, some of them our friends, stood absolutely still, fear in their eyes. At first, Mother, Grandma, and Daddy stood paralyzed. Then, Mother took a deep breath, stepped forward, and said in a commanding voice, "Even when we're being overcharged?" "You just watch your mouth, or you all will be eating beans next month." The grocer was shaking his fist at Mother Lois. There was fire in Daddy's eyes, but once again, Grandma looked at him, and he backed out. The three of them cowered like children before a chastising parent. There was a long moment of complete silence. All at once, Grandma started to pull dollars out of her purse, and Daddy did the same. Together, they paid the full amount. Mama quickly shoved Conrad and me out the door. We'd make do with what was in our cupboards for the next few days, Daddy said. We wouldn't be going to that store anymore. On the way home, Grandma fussed and fumed, saying she was fed up with buying day-old bread and slightly rotting meat for 1.5 times the price fresh food was sold to white folks. I couldn't stop wondering why Mama, Grandma, and Daddy couldn't talk back to that white man. Daddy was a tall man, over 6'4". With broad shoulders and big muscles in his arms. He could toss me in the air and catch me or hoist me over the fence with ease. Until that moment, I had thought he could take on the world if he had to protect me. But watching him kowtow to the grocer made me know it wasn't so. It frightened me and made me think a lot about how, if I got into trouble with white people, the folks I counted on most in my life for protection couldn't help me at all. I was beginning to resign myself to the fact that white people were definitely in charge, and there was nothing we could do about it. The next day, Grandma called all her friends and tried to get them to agree to form a group to shop across town. All but one person warned her not to cause trouble. After she had dialed at least 10 numbers, she sank down into her chair with a sad face and placed the receiver in its cradle. She sat silent for a long while. Then she picked up her Bible and read aloud the verse that cleared away the tears in her eyes. "An Ethiopia shall stretch forth her wings." With a smile on her face and fire in her eyes, she said, "Be patient. Our people's turn will come. You'll see. Your lifetime will be different from mine. I might not live to see the changes, but you will. Oh, yes, my child. You will." But as time passed without significant changes in my life, I was becoming increasingly anxious, waiting for Ethiopia to stretch forth her wings. In my diary, I wrote, "What if Grandma is wrong? What if God can't fix things? What if the white people are always going to be in charge? God, now, please give me some sign you are there and you are going to do something to change my life. Please hurry." Melba Patillo, age 8, a Sunday school student. I was as impatient for change as I was with the location of the restrooms marked colored. As a child, it seemed they were always located miles away from wherever I was when I felt the urge to go. When we shopped in the downtown stores, the restrooms were usually located at the end of a dark hallway or at the bottom of a dingy stairwell. It never failed that either I dampened my pants trying to get there in time or, worse yet, got a horrible ache in my side trying to hold my water until I got home. An experience I endured on a December morning would forever affect any decision I made to go potty in a public place. We were Christmas shopping when I felt the twinge of emergency. I convinced mother and grandmother that I knew the way to the restroom by myself. I was moving as fast as I could when suddenly I knew I wasn't going to make it all the way down those stairs and across the warehouse walkway to the colored ladies' toilet. So I pushed open the door marked white ladies and, taking a deep breath, I crossed the threshold. It was just as bright and pretty as I had imagined it to be. At first, I could only hear voices nearby, but when I stepped through a second doorway, I saw several white ladies chatting and fussing with their makeup. Across the room, other white ladies sat on a couch reading the newspaper. Suddenly realizing I was there, two of them looked up at me in astonishment. "Unless I was the maid," they said, "I was in the wrong place." But it was clear I was too young to be the maid. While they shouted at me to get out, my throbbing bladder consumed my attention as I frantically headed for the unoccupied stall. They kept shouting, "Good Lord, do something!" I was doing something by that time, seated comfortably on the toilet, listening to the hysteria building outside my locked stall. One woman even knelt down to peep beneath the door to make certain I didn't put my bottom on the toilet seat. She ordered me not to pee. At first, there was so much carrying on outside my stall that I was afraid to come out. But I wanted to see all the special things about the white lady's restroom, so I had no choice. A chorus of "nigger" and other nasty words billowed around me as I washed my hands. One woman waved her finger in my face, warning me that her friend had gone after the police and they would teach me a thing or two. Hearing the word police terrified me. Daddy and Mother Lois were afraid of the police. The ladies were hurrying out through the door, saying they were going to tell the manager that they would never shop in that store again. Just then, I heard a familiar voice.
Melba Joy Patillo, just what are you doing in there?
It was Grandma India calling out to me. She stepped inside the room. I was so happy to see her that I rushed to give her a hug. But the fear in her voice brought back my fear. My curiosity had gotten us into a real mess, she said. The police and a whole bunch of white folks were outside waiting for me. Grandma pushed me away and wiped my tears. And even as she straightened the bow on my braid, those voices were shouting at us through the door.
I'm demanding you all get out of here right now. I'm with the Little Rock police. Don't make us come in after you.
Grandma straightened her shoulders, assuming the posture of a queen as she reached down to take my hand and instructed me to stand tall. As we walked through the door, I tilted my chin upward to match her chin as she looked the two policemen right in the eye. She spoke to them in a calm, clear voice, explaining that I was not good at reading signs. Then she apologized for any inconvenience I had caused. Her voice didn't sound frightened, but I could feel her hand shaking and the perspiration in her palm. Suddenly, one of the officers moved close and blocked our way, saying we had to come upstairs for a serious talk. Grandma didn't flinch as he moved too close to her. Instead, she smiled down at me and squeezed my hand. But as he beckoned her to move ahead, I knew we were in more trouble than we'd ever been in before. When she asked where he was taking us, he told her to shut up and do as we were told. Some of the crowd moved with us. When we passed close to Mother Lois, she and Grandma talked to each other with their eyes. I started to speak, but Grandma pinched my arm. Once inside the upstairs room with the straight-back wooden chairs, long table, and cardboard boxes, both officers lit cigarettes. One of them said we must be part of a communist group from up north, trying to integrate Little Rock's bathrooms. Grandma's voice only cracked once, as over and over again she insisted that I had made a mistake. She called them, sir. And, mister, as she protested that we were good Little Rock citizens, grateful for the use of our own bathrooms. She said she remembered the time when we couldn't even enter the front door of the store, and she was humbly grateful for that privilege. Finally, after an hour, the older policeman said he'd let us go, calling us harmless niggers gone astray. But he warned, if we were ever again caught being curious about what belonged to white folks, we'd be behind bars wearing stripes, or even worse, wearing ropes around our necks. As we climbed into the car, Grandmother India warned me that curiosity killed the cat, and it was going to be my undoing. As punishment for my bad deed, she made me read the 23rd Psalm every day for a month. I also had to look up patience in the dictionary and write down the definition. In a way, she was right. Patience was slowly bringing changes. I was so fascinated with the idea that I had to see this school. So she began driving the whole family past the university extension on Sunday afternoon rides. It was located in the kind of all-white neighborhood we only dared travel through during the day. I craned my neck to look at the pretty houses and manicured lawns. Sometimes, on our way there, we passed Central High School. So tall, so majestic, like a European castle I'd seen in history books.
Wow, that's a lot bigger than our high school, I said one Sunday. I want to go there. May Brown cooks there, Grandma said. She tells me that's where the richest white families send their children. Folks up north know about Central High School. They know it's a good school. I wish I could see what's inside, I said.
Don't you dare even say that, girl. Curiosity gets a body in a whole lot of trouble. Be patient,
Grandma commanded once more as she smiled at me.
Be patient, and one day, God willing, you'll see inside that school. I promise.
3. How could I ever forget May 17, 1954, the day the Supreme Court ruled in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, that separate public schools for whites and blacks were illegal. The adults around me behaved so strangely that their images became a freeze frame, forever preserved in my mind. I learned lessons on that day that I will remember for the rest of my life. I was 12 years old. That afternoon, I sat at my desk in my 7th grade class at Dunbar Junior High, copying from the blackboard. My teacher had been called outside. When she returned, she appeared frightened and nervous. Erasing the blackboard before we could finish our copying, she spoke breathlessly about Brown v. Board of Education.
Does that mean we have to go to school with white people?
My friend Carl asked as a chorus of voices echoed his question.
Yes, maybe, but you needn't concern yourself with that. Collect your things. You all are dismissed early today.
Although she said the Brown case was something we should be proud of, something to celebrate, her face didn't look at all happy. I didn't understand why she was in such a big rush to dismiss us that way, but I didn't ask. Going home to be with my grandmother India was something I looked forward to every day. Peering over the book or newspaper she was reading, she would always greet me the same way.
And what did you learn today?
She hadn't finished high school, but she had read lots of books, and she studied everything and everybody all the time. Over an after-school snack of warm gingerbread and milk, the two of us would talk and laugh until it was time for me to start my chores and homework. Now, as we left school, I heard my teacher's quivering voice.
Pay attention to where you're walking. Walk in groups. Don't walk alone.
She stood at the top of the steps, telling us to hurry. Once outside, I realized I had forgotten a math book, but when I tried to get it, she blocked my way, telling me that I should go on with the others. I couldn't imagine why she was so insistent that I hurry home. She even said she would excuse my homework assignment the next day. She had never excused undone homework for any reason before. I trailed behind the others as I pondered her strange behavior. I paid little attention to where I was going. It was, after all, a familiar route, one I had walked since age 6. I usually took a shortcut across a vacant block through a grassy field filled with persimmon trees. In spring, ripened fruit littered the ground to make walking a hazardous, slippery adventure. Sometimes it wasn't always safe to take that shortcut because of Marissa. She was an older girl who frightened us. She would suddenly become very mean, striking out for no reason. I would be walking along that path, and all at once, I'd be attacked by a shower of overripe persimmons. There was no way I could protect myself or fight back because Marissa was so big and overpowering. At 12, I was considered tall for my age. Most folks thought I was 15, but Marissa was even bigger. Nobody knew how old she was. We thought she was about 16. Much too old to be in our class. Marissa was different. The teachers called her retarded. Even though she often misbehaved, adults never did anything about it, maybe because her father was a rich minister in our community. As I crossed the field, I knew that I risked having Marissa rush out of the bushes at any moment, But I also knew I could get past her if I gave her my lunch apple or my allowance money. Otherwise, I felt I was pretty safe in that field, safe enough to lapse into my daydreams. This was my special time of the day, when I could sing as loud as I wanted and make up new daydreams about being a movie star, or moving north to New York, or out west to California. I didn't agree with the radio announcers who described Little Rock as a nice, clean southern town, a place where my people and whites got along peacefully. City officials boasted there hadn't been a Klan hanging of one of our people in at least 10 years. They called our citizens forward-thinking because they were completing construction of the Strategic Air Command military base nearby that brought in lots of different races of people. But I didn't think we were so progressive because I still couldn't eat at the lunch counter at the Five and Dime, go to a movie unless I sat in the balcony, ride the merry-go-round at Fair Park, or go into the white lady's bathroom. The city's fathers bragged about the way our people and white folks were working side by side. Of the 107,300 Little Rock citizens, blacks numbered about 30,000. They said blacks earned good wages, but that wasn't true. Most of my people who earned tolerable salaries were either teachers, preachers, or doctors. For us, there were very few jobs as clerks, policemen, bus drivers, or insurance salesmen. My mother had long ago grown weary of trying to get Daddy to finish up his university courses. In fact, she had given up on him by the time I was 7. That's when they divorced. Even though he had been gone from the house almost 5 years, I still missed him, most often at dinner time and on those evenings when we gathered in the dining room for family games. It made Conrad and me sad not to have him there. At first, when Grandmother told me to set the dinner table, I would fix a place for him. Then I would remember he wouldn't be coming home. He wouldn't be eating with us. Maybe not ever. Often on those walks home from school, I daydreamed that we were a family again, that Daddy finished school to make Mother happy, and she canceled the divorce to let him come back home. As I entered the persimmon field, I sank deep into my thoughts, but a few steps past the big tree at the front of the path, I heard a rustling sound. I stood perfectly still, looking all around. I didn't see a soul. Suddenly, as I came near to the end of the field, a man's gravel voice snatched me from the secret place in my head. "You want a ride, girl?" He didn't sound at all like anybody I knew. There it was again, that stranger's voice calling out to me, "Want a ride? Who is it?" I asked, barely able to squeeze the words out. "I got candy in the car. Lots of candy." I crept forward, and then I saw him. A big white man, even taller than my father, broad and huge like a wrestler. He was coming toward me fast. I turned on my heels and fled in the opposite direction, back the way I had come. "You better come on and take a ride home. You hear me, girl?" "No, sir," I yelled. "No, thank you." But he kept coming. My heart was racing almost as fast as my feet. I couldn't hear anything except for the sound of my saddle shoes pounding the ground and the thud of his feet close behind me. That's when he started talking about niggers, wanting to go to school with his children and how he wasn't going to stand for it. My cries for help drowned out the sound of his words, but he laughed and said it was no use because nobody would hear me. I was running as fast as I could. The lace on my shoe came untied. My feet got tangled. As I hit the ground, I bit down hard on my tongue. I felt his strong hands clutch my back. I bolted up, struggling to get away. He pulled me down and turned me on my back. I looked up into his face, looming close above me like the monster on a movie screen. I struggled against him, but he was too strong. He slapped me hard across the face. I covered my eyes with my hands and waited for him to strike me again. Instead, I felt him squirm against me, and then I saw him taking his pants down. In my house, private parts were always kept private. I couldn't figure out what he was doing, but I knew it had to be bad. I scratched and kicked and thrashed against him with every ounce of strength I could muster. His huge fist smashed hard against my face. I struggled to push him back and to keep the dark curtain of unconsciousness from descending over me.
"I'll show you niggas the Supreme Court can't run my life," he said, as his hand ripped at my underpants.
A voice inside my head told me I was going to die, that there was nothing I could do about it. White men were in charge. But then I could hear Grandma India saying over and over again, "God is always with you." I fought to keep my underpants and to roll the man off of me. All at once, he frowned and let out an awful moan and grabbed for the back of his head. It was Marissa banging on his head with her leather book bag.
"Melba! Melba! Run!" she shouted.
When he rolled off me, I scrambled free. He reached out for Marissa, but she kicked him in the shoulder. That's when I managed to get to my feet and move away from him. He was still on his knees, struggling to untangle himself, his legs caught up in his unzipped pants. Marissa shouted to me to run faster. She let go of her book bag and dragged me by my arm. "If we didn't hurry, we'd get raped," she said over and over.
"Raped? What's raped?"
I asked as we scurried across the field and back into the street. We raced up the middle of the street, not stopping to talk to anybody, not even the people we knew who tried to say hello. Breathless and shaken, we finally reached my backyard. My brother, Conrad, braked his bicycle to question me. What was the matter with my face? Why were my clothes torn? I felt ashamed as I wondered if he and his playmate Clark could guess that a strange man had touched me. Just then Grandma India opened the back door. As soon as she looked at me, she frowned and sent Conrad and Clark away. Marissa explained what had happened to us, and she repeated the word rape.
"But he didn't do it all the way," she said.
By then, I had figured out it was something awful and dirty. Before I could ask Grandma more about it, she put a cold cloth to my face and rushed me into the bathtub.
"Now you soak a while, child. When the water goes down the drain, it will take away all that white man's evil with it."
She had a curious look on her face, one I'd never seen before. Then she said something that made me realize just how awful things really were.
"We'll burn the clothes you took off. I got your fresh clothing on a stool just outside the door."
I couldn't believe my ears. Waste not, want not had always been her rule. What happened must have been truly disgusting to make her destroy my good clothing. I sat in silence, wondering if I could ever redeem myself in the eyes of the Lord. Later, I heard Grandma talking to my father on the telephone as Mother Lois came in the back door with her usual cheerful greetings. I didn't climb out of the tub. Instead, I scrubbed myself in those hot suds to wash away my shame. When Grandma came to check on me, she must have seen the distress in my expression, because she promised the Lord would still count me as one of his good girls because I hadn't done anything wrong. I listened for so long while the grown-ups argued in loud whispers about calling the police that my bath water turned cold. As I climbed out of the tub and got dressed, I heard Daddy's voice. When I walked into the kitchen, for the first time ever, I saw tears in my father's eyes. As he reached to hug me, he said,
"We ain't gonna call the law. Those white police are liable to do something worse to her than what already happened."
Grandma told me not to talk about what had happened with anyone, especially not Conrad. She said I had to pray for that evil white man, pray every day for 21 days, asking God to forgive him and teach him right. That way, she promised I'd get over the feelings of shame. I wore my knees out praying night after night. I even got up early to get in extra prayers. Grandma was right. By the time my bruises went away, I didn't feel ashamed anymore. In my diary, I wrote, "It's important for me to read the newspaper every single day God sends, even if I have to spend my own nickel to buy it. I have to keep up with what the men on the Supreme Court are doing. That way, I can stay home on the day the justices vote decisions that make white men want to rape me." The daily papers were full of news about the Brown v. Board of Education case. Little Rock's white people were saying the same things as the raping man had said. I couldn't imagine they would ever change their minds and allow their children to go to school with me, no matter what laws those men on the Supreme Court made. But on May 24, 1955, the newspaper said the Little Rock School Board had adopted a plan to limit integration to Central High School. They weren't going to allow it to actually begin, however, for 2 years. Not till September 1957. When my teacher asked if anyone who lived within the Central High School District wanted to attend school with white people, I raised my hand. As I signed my name on the paper they passed around, I thought about all those times I'd gone past Central High wanting to see inside. I was certain it would take a miracle to integrate Little Rock schools. But I reasoned that if schools were open to my people, I would also get access to other opportunities I had been denied, like going to shows at Robertson Auditorium or sitting on the first floor of the movie theater. By December 1, 1955, I began to realize that Grandma was right. Our people were stretching out to knock down the fences of segregation. I read in the newspaper that one of our people, a woman named Rosa Parks, had refused to give up her seat to a white man on an Alabama bus. Her willingness to be arrested rather than give in one more time led to the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. I felt such a surge of pride when I thought about how my people had banded together to force a change. It gave me hope that maybe things in Little Rock could change. In January 1956, my hopes were dashed when NAACP officials tried to register a few of our children in several white high schools in Little Rock and were turned back. Grandma India and Mother Lois followed the story closely, but when we discussed it over dinner, the talk about white people doing bad things to us kept me from telling them I had signed the list to go to Central High. On February 8th, 1956, the NAACP filed suit in federal district court to make the schools integrate immediately, referring to a poll that said 85% of all Arkansas's people opposed integration. Governor Orville Faubus announced his refusal to support the integration of our state's schools. In the spring of 1956, I read that Elvis Presley was coming downtown to Little Rock's Robinson Auditorium. As I sat in the middle of my bed among my stuffed animals, looking at his picture in the ad, I was heartbroken that I couldn't go. Our people were not even allowed to sit in the balcony during such social events. How many times had I asked my parents, "Why? Why can't I go everywhere whites can go?" And I was really disappointed when I read that some of the city's prominent white citizens were threatening lawsuits to delay the Little Rock School Board's integration plan until 1970. I was certain they'd succeed. They always had things their way. On August 27, 1956, Federal Judge John Miller dismissed the NAACP suit for immediate school integration, saying it was all right for the school board to integrate gradually. I knew that meant very, very slowly, or not at all. Later, there was an appeal supported by NAACP attorney Thurgood Marshall, but the appeal was lost, and the school board's stingy plan to integrate only a little bit was deemed deliberate and speedy. During the summer of 1957, Central High seemed to be just one more place I wasn't going to see the inside of. In early August of 1957, Johnny Mathis had his first big song, Chances Are, on the hit parade. That month, a Mrs. Clyde Thomason, secretary of a new group called the League of Central High Mothers, filed a petition for an injunction to keep the Little Rock School Board from carrying out its gradual integration plan. About that time, I decided to quit worrying about whether I should tell my parents I had signed up to go to Central. After all, if white mothers were fighting integration, it had little chance of success. I knew very well the power of my own mother and grandmother. Besides, I needed all my mind space for living my daydreams, since Conrad, mother, grandmother, and I were about to go north. We were driving to Cincinnati, Ohio, to visit my great-uncle Clancy, on mother's side of the family. He was an Episcopalian priest, and his wife, Julie, was a music teacher. As we pulled into the circular drive, their spacious, fancy house reminded me of the kinds of places I'd seen in the movies. It resembled our Little Rock Bank in size and was surrounded by hedges with planned shapes like an artist had sculpted them. For me, Cincinnati was the promised land. After a few days there, I lost that Little Rock feeling of being choked and kept in my place by white people. They weren't in charge of me and my family in Cincinnati. I felt free, as though I could soar above the clouds. I was both frightened and excited when the white neighbors who lived across the street invited me for dinner. It was the first time white people had ever wanted to eat with me or talk to me about ordinary things. Over the dinner table, I found out they were people, just like me. They used the same blue linen dinner napkins that Grandma India favored. They treated me like I was an equal, like I belonged with them. Afterward, we went to a drive-in movie. The neighbor's daughter, Cindy, who was exactly my age, stood beside me as I walked right up to the concession stand to buy my popcorn. No one even looked at me with evil eyes or called me a name. Still, my heart was pounding and my palms were wet as I squeezed through that big crowd of white people to get back to the car. Right in the middle of downtown Cincinnati, we walked with our heads held high, acting as proud as could be. Neither mother nor grandmother ever once stepped aside to let a white person pass. Sometimes we held our ground and white people walked around us, even smiled hello as they did so. We sauntered through all the big department stores, touching expensive things without the white clerks giving us a second look. I even used the restroom, and the white lady smiled and said hello. Later, as I sat at the lunch counter in the five and dime to have a root beer, I could hardly eat for keeping watch all around me. But no white person so much as frowned at me. That evening, Uncle Clancy took us to a fancy restaurant where white waiters smiled and bowed and asked if I wanted anything. Melba will be hard to get along with after all this spoiled treatment, Mama said as we ate, laughed, and talked. I'd never had lobster or cottage fries before, or had a white man play the piano just to make my meal go down easy. It was mid-August, and we'd been in paradise for more than a week. I was wondering how I could tell Mama I wasn't ever going back to Little Rock. I planned to beg and plead with Uncle Clancy to let me live with them and finish high school in Cincinnati. I thought I had a pretty good chance of having things go my way, until one evening when we sat watching the national news.
"That was your father on the phone."
Mother appeared to be annoyed as she spoke.
"He said to pay close attention to the news because he got a call today saying Melba's been assigned to go to Central High with the white people."
All ears perked up when the announcer started talking about Little Rock. He said 17 children from my community had been selected to enter the all-white Central High School in the 1957 fall term. Grandma stood and walked over to the television set, signaling us to be silent. The announcer talked about Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP asking the federal district court to start integration immediately. A judge had agreed and issued an order preventing Mrs. Thomason and her mother's group from interfering. We all stood like statues as the newsmen talked about Little Rock's segregationists, who were determined to stop our children from entering white schools at any cost. I couldn't make myself stand still. An awful fear vibrated through my body. Conrad asked if he could go, too. Grandma India said an emphatic no. By then, Mother was pale, her lips drawn tight as she glared at me. All of them circled around me, like the covered wagons I'd seen in Western movies when settlers wanted to fend off an Indian attack. With horrified expressions, they looked at me as though I had lied or sassed Grandma or grown a second nose. I stood in the middle of the room, hoping the floor would swallow me up as they grilled me. When had I planned on telling them? Why did I sign my name to the paper saying I lived near Central and wanted to go without asking their permission? Did I consider that my decision might endanger our family? All the while I was trying to back away from their harsh inquisition. I no longer cared the least bit about Little Rock. I just wanted to live right there in Cincinnati. It was like a nightmare. Suddenly my joy and freedom ended. All night they yelled and paced and discussed. By morning, Mama wasn't talking to me. She ate breakfast with a frown on her face. Grandma's mouth was poked out, but she talked to me, saying over and over again that I was too smart for my britches. That was the end of my vacation. We hurried home to begin living a life I had never imagined in my wildest dreams. Grandma called it all Hades breaking loose. 4. By the time we arrived home from Cincinnati, my life was already upside down. I was living with one concern, preparing to take part in the integration of Central High School. It consumed much of the time and energy of my entire family. I could see it was consuming the energy of the entire city. Nobody I spoke with or watched on local television or heard on the radio talked of anything else. I was drowning in unfamiliar activities and sounds, the sound of the constantly ringing telephone, of people talking loud in my ear and expressing their views about integration, of reporters' urgent voices describing what integration might do to the city and the South, and of official-looking adults lecturing me about integration for hours in closed meetings. Meetings. My life was filled with meetings. Boring meetings with the white superintendent of schools, the school board, with Central High School officials, with NAACP officials. For the first time, I met Mrs. Daisy Bates, a petite and smartly dressed,
steely-eyed woman who was the Arkansas state president of the NAACP. She seemed very calm and brave, considering the caravans of segregationists said to be driving past her house and tossing firebombs and rocks through her windows. They saw her as their enemy, not only because of her position, but because she and her husband owned the Arkansas State Press, a newspaper that was the sole voice for our community. I watched her in action as she spoke up on our behalf during one of those first meetings with members of the school administration. They made it clear they were not our friends and that it would be better if we changed our minds and returned to our own school. Right away, they warned us that we would not be permitted to participate in any extracurricular activities. Absolutely not, voices chimed in unison, and their collective heads shook no. Would we like to withdraw because of that fact? They asked. Although we all were startled by their declaration and their question, we took only a moment to reply. We would continue, no matter what. The only good thing about the meetings was that they allowed me to visit with my friends, the other students who would be integrating Central. I had known most of them all my life. At one point, there had been 16 others, but some of them chose not to participate because of the threats of violence. It frightened me to see our number dwindling. Still, I was delighted with those I knew were definitely going. In the end, there were 9 of us. Ernest Green, the oldest and a senior, was a member of my church. His warm eyes and quick smile greeted me each week at Sunday school. His aunt, Mrs. Gravely, had taught me history in junior high. Tall, thin, Terrence Roberts was a junior like me and a friend since first grade. He was a very verbal person who could be counted on to give the funniest, most intelligent analysis of any situation. I adored his way of always humming a cheerful tune when he wasn't talking. Jefferson Thomas was a quiet, soft-spoken athlete, tops in his class. His sense of humor was subtle, the kind that makes you giggle aloud when you're not supposed to. Elizabeth Eckford was petite, a very quiet, private person who had smiled and waved at me across the hallway at our old school. She was regal in her bearing and, like all of us, very serious about her studies. Thelma Mothershed and I were friends who saw each other frequently. Small like Elizabeth, but with a very pale complexion, her wise eyes peered through thick-lensed, horn-rimmed glasses. She had a heart problem that, at times, changed her pallor to a purplish hue and forced her to rest on her haunches to catch her breath. Best of all, my special friend, Minnie Jean Brown, was going. Since she lived only a block away from me, we saw each other almost every day. We had much in common. Both of us were tall for our age, and we shared daydreams, our worship of Johnny Mathis and Nat Cole, and our desire to sing. Carlotta Walls was an athlete, very sleek and wonderfully energetic. Everything she said or did was quickly executed. She was a girl-next-door type, always in a good mood, always ready to try something new. Gloria Ray was another member of my Sunday school class. Delicate in stature, she was as meticulous about her attire as she was about her studies. Her all-knowing eyes grew even more intense as she spoke in softly measured words. We integrating students shared many things in common. All of our parents were strict, no-nonsense types. Several of them were teachers and preachers or held well-established positions in other professions. All our folks were hard-working people who had struggled to own their homes, to provide a stable life for their families. We shared many of the same family values traditional to all small-town Americans. Our parents demanded that we behave appropriately at home and in public.
I couldn't imagine that any one of us would ever talk back to our folks or other adults. All of us were church-going. All our parents demanded good grades in school. Although none of us had a lot of money, we had pride in our appearance. Most of all, we were individualists with strong opinions. Each of us planned to go to college. I felt comfortable being with them because they were the kind of people my mother allowed me to associate with. And after a period of being together so much, I began to feel as though we had formed some kind of group, an odd family of people with one goal, to get inside Central High and stay there for the school year. All my friends, adults and children alike, developed some strange need to discuss their feelings about integration. Even strangers stopped me on the street. The opinions weren't always positive, even among my own people, as I discovered at my church one Sunday. I was startled when a woman I'd seen often enough but didn't really know began lecturing me. For a moment, I feared she was going to haul off and hit me. She was beside herself with anger. I could barely get my good morning in because she was talking very loud, attracting attention as she told me I was too fancy for my britches and that other people in our community would pay for my uppity need to be with white folks. Taken aback by her anger, I stood perfectly still, stunned. I knew very well I couldn't talk back to adults, so I kept my mouth shut, even though I wanted to tell her a thing or two. Just as I thought I couldn't hold my words in a moment longer, a family friend walked by and grabbed hold of her arm. He wouldn't let her get another word in edgewise as he explained that he believed Little Rock white folks were ready for a change, and we were just reminding them it was time by registering at Central High. I hoped he was right about whites being ready for change. At first, it seemed they had accepted the limited integration plan. I had heard only a few of my people say they expected a big problem. Oh, sure. Nobody said it would be easy, but most thought it would be like integrating the buses. There would be quiet fussing and complaining and a few threats from the white folks. Then things would settle down. But just before school started, we notice in the newspaper half-page invitations to big states' rights rallies where important white people urged everybody to fight integration. At one such rally, Georgia Governor Marvin Griffin addressed a statewide meeting of about 400 people who came for a dinner. He attacked the Supreme Court decision favoring integration, saying it took away the rights of states to govern themselves. The newspaper said Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus would have breakfast with Griffin the next morning. I worried about that meeting because I thought he would sway Faubus to do things his way. That could change our plans again. One more change and I'd be ready to pack and move to anywhere, USA. Since I had arrived home from vacation, I didn't know from minute to minute or day to day where I would be starting my school year. The on-again, off-again calls from the NAACP were beginning to make me nervous, even though I knew they were doing their best to help us. On Thursday, August 29th, 1957, just 5 days before school started, a headline in the Arkansas Gazette read, "State Court Rules Against Integration." Peering above the newspaper, Grandma sighed as she told me I'd better get ready to go back to my old school because it seemed as if Mrs. Thomason's segregationist group had convinced Judge Reed that kids from our community and white students were buying guns. Governor Faubus backed up Mrs. Thomason's testimony, saying he knew personally she was telling the truth. So Reed believed her and ruled against integration, saying it would cause violence. I felt sad and angry that there was no hope things would ever get any better. I called my friends and got set for a year I assumed would be kind of okay because of the added privileges and respect granted a junior. I figured integration had been put off for that school year and maybe forever. Meanwhile, I was rethinking my plan to entice my family to move to Cincinnati. But on Sunday evening, September 1st, 2 days before school was to start, word came from the NAACP not to register at our regular high school. NAACP lawyers had already gone to federal court to get us into Central High. They expected a favorable ruling. On Monday, September 2nd, Labor Day, our family gathered at Auntie May's house for the last picnic of the summer. She was Mother's sister, a wonderfully round, cuddly woman with flowing wavy hair and a warm smile. A real live wire. She liked to play pranks on people and tell the kind of naughty jokes that made Mother blush and cover my ears. Her laughter and upbeat attitude always cheered me up. People said I had some of her feisty ways in me. I was certain my Auntie May could do just about anything. "Rules are made to be broken," she said. "If there's anyone who can integrate that school, it's you. You're just sassy enough to pull it off. Although I don't know why you'd want to go where you're not wanted," said Uncle Charlie, Mother's brother, puffing on his cigar as he hung his fedora on the hat rack by the front door. "To heck with them," said Auntie May. "Besides, I heard a rumor that Governor Faubus is going to send the National Guard over to the school." "How do you know that?" "Mamie Johnson's cousin cooks for that school. They called to tell her where she has to check in tomorrow morning to get past the soldiers." That began a free-for-all about integration. It was just what I didn't want to hear. So I drifted off into my daydreams about Vince, the cute boy I liked. I pictured what it might have been like to have him pick me up in his new car at our old school where everybody could see. Later on that night, Grandma thought we should listen to the governor's speech on television. To our amazement, he announced he had sent troops to Central. And then he said, "They will not act as segregationists or integrationists, but as soldiers called to active duty to carry out their assigned tasks." Then he spoke the words that made chills creep up and down my spine. "But I must state here, in all sincerity, that it is my opinion, yes, even a conviction, that it will not be possible to restore or maintain order and protect the lives and property of the citizens if forcible integration is carried out tomorrow in the schools of this community." "The governor has finally flipped his wig," Mother Lois said, glaring at the moon-faced man on the TV screen. "He's stirring up trouble by talking about trouble," Grandma added. She was right, as usual. Following that speech, calls from telephone hecklers began to drive us wild. Several times during the days and nights before school opened, those voices had growled at me. "Niggers don't belong in our schools. You all are made for hanging," one harsh voice shouted the first time I picked up the receiver. On the night of the governor's speech, the phone didn't stop ringing. One caller said he knew our address and would be right over to bomb the house. Grandma went directly to her room, where she took the shotgun she called Mr. Higginbottom from its leather case in the back of her closet. That night, she set up her guard post near the window to the side yard where she thought we were most vulnerable. She sat in her rocking chair beside the antique mahogany end table given her by her mother. After a moment for contemplation and prayer, she stretched her embroidery work tightly over its hoop. With her needles and threads, she settled down for the night with Mr. Higginbottom across her lap. She sat as erect as those heroic soldiers I'd seen in magazine pictures. When Mother offered to spell her, she told her to get a good night's sleep so she could be fresh for her teaching job. As I tried to fall asleep,